Solitaire Rose Radio, episode 46. Devil's Due, writer, artist, publisher, Josh Blaylock. One of the things I've been doing lately, as I'm going to conventions and meeting new people and growing the podcast, really, is I'm meeting more and more comic creators. And what I like to do, if you go to my Facebook page or you kind of know me, if I like a comic or I'm excited about a comic or I'm excited about a creator, I tend to really want to push that creator. I tend to really want to let people know. I think one of the things about comics is our little world, we tend to get siloed. Oh, I just read Marvel. Oh, I just read DC. Oh, I just read this. Oh, I just read that. And I've always been someone who tries to read a whole bunch of everything. One of the smaller publishers that I pick up books from every so often is Devil's Due. DevilsDue.net is their website. Josh Blaylock is kind of the creative force, the big high muckety muck, and the guy behind the Kickstarter of Mercy Sparks. And while he doesn't talk a lot about Mercy Sparks in this episode, we talk about the history of Devil's Due, where it came from, how it got the licensed properties in the early 2000s. And the thing that I really enjoyed about this interview is learning the nuts and bolts. How do you find out about licenses? How do you start deciding that not only am I just going to be an artist, am I just going to be a writer, or am I just going to publish it all? Josh was very generous with his time. So we have a two-part interview. This interview goes into sort of the history of Devil's Due and where it came from. And then the second part of the interview, which comes Friday, talks more about Mercy Sparks and other things like that. But Josh was very generous with his time, and I'm very excited to bring you the interview. Devil's Due's been around for a while. I remember when you guys were being distributed by Image. You guys had the Micronauts. That was when I first heard about you.
Yeah.
And I bought the comics and the little tiny trade paperbacks. You did like paperback book size.
Yeah, that was when, I don't know exactly why we did that, but manga was coming into the bookstores and bookstores really wanted to carry everything really badly that had anything to do with comics, and I don't know, for some reason we wanted to try that digest size, but
well, Marvel did a bunch of them too.
I think we had to make it a full size.
What I wanted to ask is, first off, when did you get bit by the bug that you wanted to create comics?
Oh man, that was probably when I was, I'd say probably when I was really around like 13, I mean, I can't remember not wanting to create, like, write and draw stories. That's been since I was literally before I could really talk very well. I wanted to be an animator. And I, like, wrote letters to Disney as a kid. Like, and shockingly, they actually sent, like, brochures and info on how to be an animator. And it's, but all I ever wrote and drew was comics. So at some point, I kind of just hit me like, oh, this is actually what I really love to do. And then started really kind of odd for my age to be getting really serious about it when I was like 14. And there were no conventions to really go to, but I lived in Cincinnati, Ohio at the time. And I'd lived in Florida before that. There's a couple like small conventions. Like Billy Tucci just put She out. Now, he was like the main guest at this Florida show. And then I think Jeff Matsuda from Extreme, it was, and some other company, I can't remember the name of, they were like the big deal at this show in Cincy. And there was no internet or anything. So you just talked to people who were actually doing it because teachers couldn't give you any advice on it. So it was like, hey, how do you do this? How do you get it in the stores? You know, and I found some nice guys who were publishing some black and white books that let me talk their ear off and ask them questions. And so that was when I really got like enough information to, you know, start going down that rabbit hole. It's actually how I got to the rabbit hole of publishing. versus just being a creator.
Yeah, I in looking through your stuff, you published something a few years ago called How to Self-Publish Comics. And it's gone through a couple of printings as well. So I want to get to that eventually, but was your first stuff through Image? Or was it published and then Image picked it up later?
Image was like my, that was the first Devil's, no, that wasn't even the first Devil's Due book, but that was the first, that G.I. Joe number one was our first book with them. And that's what put me on the map. And that was when I was, you know, I quit my quote unquote real job for that. Now before that, I started, self-publishing right out of high school. I graduated 95 and I had a couple things lined up because it was a crazy 90s industry at the time where they would actually publish you even though if you weren't very good and you had to comic at 18. And then it fell through and I just decided, you know what, I'm going to do this on my own. I learned enough to get it out there and put a book out called Minotaur that was all black and white. And my company was called Labyrinth Studios. Then I changed that once I realized people couldn't say or spell Labyrinth. Minotaur came out. That was, I think like March of 96. And you know, Diamond. It went so long ago. It wasn't just Diamond. It went through Capital, which is the other big distributor then. And, we put out four issues of that. Then I put out a book called Penguin Brothers. I put out a couple other books and changed it. Devil's Due, I think I put out, it was a book called Misplaced, which I put out in like 2000, late 2000, like right before, you know, the G.I. Joe stuff happened.
Okay. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting about that, there were a lot of people in comics at the time, and when the industry collapsed, there were long-time comic artists who were self-publishing or even bigger publishers who threw in the towel. You, on the other hand, said, no, I'm going to do this myself. So was it you just wanted it so bad or you really thought that you had something that other people didn't?
I just wanted it so bad. And I, you know, it's like, I think this kind of was a pattern through my career for like since the beginning was, you know, it was like the perfect age to see all those dudes from leave Marvel, start Image Comics and just crush it. And then see all these newcomers popping out of nowhere, making black and white books that sold 50,000 copies an issue and being like, oh, that's a decent start, you know, and I wanted it so badly. I could taste it, you know, and then just as I got old enough to like really finally get out there and do my own stuff, the market crashed like crazy a couple of years before that. And I was foolish enough to just keep continuing it. So, and I even when we came out with G.I. Joe number one, that was when, you know, Marvel had, I think still, I don't know if they were still on the edge of bankruptcy, but, you know,
they were bankrupt.
Didn't know what the fuck they were doing. Huh?
They were bankrupt until at least 2000 and maybe 2001, because I'd always heard the X-Men movie is kind of what finally pulled them out of bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And that came in 2000.
And, you know, and like the industry was totally different then too, though, and it wasn't doing that great. And that's when, you know, Marvel was like, hey, Quesada and Palmiotti, screw around and do some stuff with our, you know, some of our characters. And, you know, and then Jemison and Quesada after that were doing some, you know, just fun stuff and riling, you know, at least stirring things up and making people talk about stuff. So, it's pretty crazy. If you go back and you look at the charts of like who the dominant companies were back then and everything, it was a totally different landscape. And the indie market was like nothing like it is now. I had actually put out a couple things as Devil's Due, and then you know, as soon as I got the license to the Joe stuff, you know, I had every intention of publishing it on my own if that was the way it needed to go, but went to a couple people and then Image Central signed it. So that was kind of history.
Now, you were a smaller publisher. G.I. Joe had just come off being at Dark Horse, where they had Frank Miller doing covers and stuff. So how does a small publisher go to Hasbro and get the rights to G.I. Joe?
I wondered that myself for a long time. It was, in hindsight, it was because they had no, like, freaking clue what to do with it. I mean, it was dead. The Marvel book hadn't been out for, you know, over 7 years. The 90s stuff was a disaster. Actually, it's funny, the guy, I forget his name. Damn, it's escaping me. This guy who, he speaks at some of the G.I. Joe conventions, who was one of the main architects of a lot of that 80s marketing. He was even talking about what a disaster the 90s stuff was, because they didn't follow any of the stuff they learned in the 80s. But, you know, in like the late 90s, early 2000s, like, nobody understood this concept of 80s retro becoming a thing. And I've actually told this story a lot. Hopefully it's new for your listeners, but I actually, I had been trying to do comic books forever, and that consumed all of my free time. And I had a day job where I fell into the world of t-shirt and accessory production, and I was working for this small company called Ripple Junction that pretty much just did tie-dyed shirts and like shirts with goofy sayings on them, like, you know, there's drink your beer, there's sober kids in India, and Grateful Dead tie-dye shirts and stuff. So they wanted to start a retro line, and the company was literally like me. I was like 20 years old, and I was their art director, which it tells you like how what level that was at the time. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And the two owners and a secretary. But they listened to me, and I actually got to be really involved in what this retro line was going to be. And I was like, you got to do this 80s stuff. And it was so tangible to me. Like, there was no doubt in my mind, because that's all anybody my age talked about, was how badly they wanted all this stuff to come back. They tried to get a hold of Hasbro for the license, and it just, Hasbro wouldn't even write the contracts to license it. They said they wanted to license, you know, classic 80s Transformers. And someone at the licensing department there, or somebody in their, like, their legal department or whatever, was like, you mean like Beast Wars? And they're like, no, we want like the old Transformers, like Optimus Prime and Megatron. And they're like, oh, we don't license. We're not doing that right now. That's old. And they're like, yeah, but classic stuff. And they're like, like, they didn't even want to like spend the money to get the paperwork, the contract out of the drawer and make a copy and send it off. Like, it was just, it was crazy. I'll never forget this guy hanging up the phone, and he's like, we'll just bootleg it. So they're thinking they're going to do like a small run and put some of these things out. And next thing you know, like, Hot Topic actually wanted to place an order for like 2,000 units of something. And then get this store called Gadzooks, all these mall stores. And it started off that company doing all this 80s stuff. And it was really awesome to be basically, you know, say that I can say, like, yeah, I really kind of was the major force that helped start that shit, and see it in the malls and see everyone enjoying that. And we learned, you know, we got legitimate licenses, you know, very quickly. So it was because they couldn't keep, you know, they realized how big it was going to be, and they were going to get in trouble if they didn't stop that. But there was, I met Peter Laird at, I think it was like Small Press Expo or something. I don't know. He was really cool to me. And I met this guy, Gary Richardson, maybe, somebody who ran Mirage Studios at the time. And okay. That owns Ninja, owned the back before they sold to Nickelodeon, owned Ninja Turtles. And the, so that was my first real official, like, you know, license, like, I got to play a part in, you know, and got to learn how to, you know, through that company, because they did know how to go get a license, how to do the basic advances and structure that, and offered royalty and everything. And then from there we did Voltron, to do a bunch of t-shirts and stuff for that, and then it kind of spun out from there. So it was a really cool job, especially if you're like, you know, I think it was like 22 by the time, but not what I wanted to do. It wasn't comic books. I was also not really happy in Cincinnati at the time, and I was really falling in love with Chicago. I moved to Chicago. But right before that, I had started Devil's Due, was doing some freelance stuff, like thinking like, oh, this will be my, you know, freelance operation for some like clients and stuff that I had for graphic design and illustration, and I'll publish my comics on the side until I can finally make the jump to do the comic books, you know, several, you know, years from now, and make that the real business. And went ahead, you know, said, all right, I know how to go try to get a license. No one, you know, I know how badly people want all this 80s shit. And, you know, that's the story I really wanted to write. It was G.I. Joe or Transformers. And I figured Transformers never really died and went dormant like G.I. Joe did. Transformers never stopped having cartoon series on the air. It was still doing really well. It was a bigger brand that would have more eyeballs on it on the corporate level. So I sent them a proposal for G.I. Joe, and like kind of to my shock, they emailed me back, and I never even saw anybody. Like, I just got some emails back and forth. I sent them the black and white books, not that Minotaur book, but the book called Penguin Brothers that I was doing, which is like this cartoony black and white book. And to my shock, this thing kept going on. I moved to Chicago thinking, you know, if this takes off, I don't want to set up roots where I am. I want to make my move before that. And, you know, but the chances of this happening are like so slim. And then actually, you know, kept happening. And finally I got, you know, a shitter get off the pot message saying, okay, you know, here's the royalty. It was some astronomically high royalty, like 15%. And, you know, we'll give you, I think they wanted $15,000 against a $30,000 guarantee or something like that. And I was like, oh, I moved to Chicago because my friend Jose Garibaldi, who I'd gotten to know through the Comic-Con circuits and how I started hanging out at his house when I was visiting here, couch surfing, he had gotten a job in an animation studio, not really an animation studio, but making illustrations and simple animations for like software, for educational software. And I was like, sweet, now's the time I make my move. This G.I. Joe stuff might happen, and if it does, you know, I'm going to work at this job and I'll just coast for like 8 months and then I'll bail. And if the G.I. Joe stuff doesn't happen, I'll still be doing comic books, and eventually someday I'll make that transition. Got to Chicago, and 2 months later they laid like everybody off. So,
oh man,
I was doing like these horrible temp jobs, you know, some were bad and some were like terrible. But I knew how to like type and how to do Excel and everything, so you can pretty much then get any job you needed to get by. And so I was in this weird temp job situation with like no money when I got that letter, but it's the one time I did like a round of like friends and family, a few $100 here and there, and credit cards and all that, got the license, and shocked, you know, still like kind of shocked the day I got the contract and signed that off. I'll remember that was June. I think I got the Image contract signed by like June of 2001. I remember June of 2001 is when I quit all that temp stuff and got the first like small office, outside of my apartment, and we had, you know, had a real contract. So from there, it was kind of, Image didn't even really know what to do with it at the time. They had no idea what they were getting into as far as how big that book was going to be, because it was their number one book. And I also think they underestimated how like just insanely serious I was about building this comic book company. Because they were used to dealing with creators on a one-on-one basis, and I wanted to build this whole thing. And I also think, I can't speak for them, but I think that they got inundated with all of the retailer phone calls and everything because I'd set it up, like, I made sure to the guys, the right people at Wizard were ready to get, like, images we were putting together. I had gotten J. Scott Campbell to agree to do the covers for it. This artist, David Beck, did these amazing covers on the back of each issue. So it just blew the hell up. It blew up on message boards. There was no social media, but it went crazy on message boards. And Wizard was running 2-page spread articles about it. So people, where they were like, who the hell are these kids coming out of nowhere? And that's what I didn't know then was the complete disconnect to the retail stores and all of that, like, fan journalism that happens. Like, there's a portion of the retailers that followed all of that, but when it came to the 80s stuff, despite what had happened in the comic shops for the last, like, two, or the malls for the last 2 or 3 years all across America with 80s retro, to where, like, those stores were almost sick of it for a while. There was so much of it. The comic shops were like, what are you talking about? What's this 80s shit? I don't want this. But then they got inundated by their customers so hard that retailers were kind of caught with their pants down a little bit. We had pre-orders for like 69,000 copies, and I went ahead and told Image to print 100,000, and they're like, oh, it's crazy, but it's our money at the end of the day, so I said, go ahead and do it, and we sold out of that. The charts used to be based on pre-orders. Now the charts are based on actual sales numbers for the month from Diamond. If they had been based on the actual sales numbers for the month, we would have been the number two comic book in the country, I think. And the only reason we wouldn't have been number one was probably because of Wolverine Origins. So it was huge. And then we sold out of, because we sold the first printing, those extra 30,000 copies, and we did a second printing. And we combined issues one and two together later. It blew up, and then the 80s retro thing was officially kicked off. So Dreamwave was making a bunch of money with, oh, what the fuck,
Transformers.
Dark Minds. They had made a bunny out of
Oh,
Dark
yeah.
Minds from Image, and then they swooped in and grabbed Transformers, and then we managed to get Voltron because I already had that relationship with Voltron. I think I talked about doing Turtles, but ironically, or it sounds stupid now, but back then I wasn't sure people would have cared as much about it. Like Turtles, they may have, but Turtles, again, Turtles never really completely ended. It had all these different versions that kept happening. It wasn't like it had been gone and people were starving for it.
And Image had tried a turtle series that just kind of limped along, if I remember, sales-wise.
Yeah, so I didn't go for that. And then Micronauts kind of happened out of more organically through other people crying out for it. So that was more, Micronauts was a little bit before all that 80s stuff, but it was right before everybody started to get their own cartoon for everything, and tied into the cartoons and lunchboxes and pajamas and all that stuff. But it was huge at the time, and especially it was a huge comic book. So the company there, Abrams Gentile, they were like really easy to work with, and Micronauts book came out that did well too. And then almost from the get-go, from the time that G.I. Joe came out, I was ready to I knew that like we were going to be the 80s guys. So being that we came out of nowhere and that no one ever heard of me before, it was really important to me to start differentiating myself, doing other types of books. We did the 80s stuff and it blew up, and that kicked off the whole crazy 80s boom for a while there and back in those days. And after a couple of years, then we started to segue into doing other titles and other licenses. And but we really couldn't ever escape being primarily a licensing company, which it is really weird. If you go back and look now at who the top companies were back then, there really wasn't, like, this licensing thing wasn't, the only people that did that before us really, it was Dark Horse with Aliens and Predator and Star Wars. And people would do movie adaptations sometimes, but now the way that the whole comic book industry is just dominated by these, you know, licensing mini conglomerates, if that's a word, you know, it's a huge chunk of comic books now. Back then, it worked because we were filling a void. Now there's like a glut.
On the crazy comics and stories, my friend Joe used to run a shop. He ran it for years and years and years, and I worked at it. And we've both combined have way too many years of comics retail. And we've actually been debating whether these licenses do what they used to do. Because what they used to do is a small company would get a license, and they could use that to kind of let people know they existed.
Totally,
so it's like, hey, we exist. Now, you know, here's our license book, but here's the other stuff that we do. And now I don't think it has that impact anymore. But with Devil's Due, you guys, you talked about how it blew up. It really blew up. And then you started putting out stuff that was, I'm going to say, a little off the beaten path. The humor books like Love Bunny and Mr. Hell. You had some other stuff from Image. Was that you trying to shift yourself away from the 80s guys? Or was this stuff that you had in your head that you were just waiting for the right time?
In hindsight, back then I would have told you it was us differentiating ourselves, but really that was showing my real tastes. Like, the stuff that I was really into was the indie stuff. And I had gotten into DC Comics as a kid, like hardcore, and still read a lot of that, but I quickly gravitated towards those old Ninja Turtle books and towards the Scud the Disposable Assassin and just a lot more. Like I love all the shit coming out now. Like, all the stuff now from all these indie companies, it's all the original stuff. I think there's a lot of amazing things out there. But back then, it wasn't nearly as, you know, people weren't as receptive to it. So it was just funny that G.I. Joe was something I was super nerdy about. I loved it. I knew everything about the history of the comic books. I knew all about the cartoon. You know, I could spout off all the factoids about that. And it just was the one thing I knew about that was the most mainstream for the comic book world. And until we put it out there, the industry didn't even know it was a mainstream thing that comic book people would eat up, just like they would X-Men. You know, so we, it was, you know, people probably just assumed that I liked all these other things that were along the same level. And I did like a lot of the 80s stuff. I think it was because I felt like, you know, that was our generation, and these like cooler, badass versions of the stories never got to be told until we were able to bring them back and do it. So I never really cared about writing a Batman story or doing any Marvel stuff. I'd always wanted to write and draw my own things. And it's still that way, kind of. So I think I'd have, you know, I wouldn't turn it down, and I'd probably be into writing a lot of certain books, but certain big high profile like superhero titles. But honestly, I couldn't even tell you much about half of them. And so that kind of showed through. Also, you know, like Love Bunny and Mr. Hell, you mentioned, that was Tim Seeley's book, and he's right in there in the same boat. You know, just always liked quirky stuff. We both tend to write a lot more like, you know, quirky female characters. And it is cool now that stuff's becoming a lot more popular. So we can honestly say, you know, I could say to the kind of stuff we've been writing forever. And, you know, he's just crushing it right now, but he is writing Batman. But like, you know, Hack Slash was one of the breakout titles. We've got, books like Love Bunny was a little weird, never caught on. There's a handful of other things too that, you know, we did it. They were fun. There was this one book we did called Radiskull and Devil Doll that was based off of a super popular Flash cartoon, on that AdamShockwave.com website. That this thing had like millions of views, and they put out a plush toy one time of this little devil character, and they blew through like 10,000 units in a week or something. And, you know, it was like a leftover element of the .com era that actually worked. And it was so ahead of its time that it would have been like Adult Swim, or it would have been a YouTube channel hit. So, you know, we put the comic book out for that, and actually Seeley wrote some of that and drew some of that. Mike Norton worked on that. I worked on it. I think guy Dave Croslin might have done some of that. Or no, I can't remember everybody on it, but it just totally like kind of fizzled. So sometimes I've got learned to be better about that, like seeing like, okay, just because we like this, is it our quirky taste? You know, sometimes we can pat ourselves on the back and say, you know what? That is gonna, people are gonna love the shit out of that in 5 years, but we need to wait. Or no, this is just weird stuff that we like that no one cares about and no one ever will care about. And you don't know which that is until you actually wait a few years. But
and with those licenses, one of the things that I always find strange is that you can't tell if a licensed thing is going to hit. Like you said, that Radiskull, millions of hits on the internet. But do those people even know that comic shops exist, let alone would go to a comic shop and spend money on it?
Yeah.
And yet with G.I. Joe, you know, here's something that Hasbro was like, yeah, sure, here, try it, whatever. And it blows up big. Whereas there's probably other things from around that time that you would have grabbed and they just would have hit the market and just laid there. So one of the hardest things, especially for retailers, is, well, what's going to hit?
Yeah.
And retailers, because they have to, you know, if they're wrong, they eat it, tend to be more conservative, as you talked about.
So, oh, yeah, Transformers was the perfect example of that. It had already been a bigger brand, but everyone was so caught so off guard with how many copies of G.I. Joe they blew through. When the Transformers book came in, they ordered heavy. So we sold close to 150,000 copies of that G.I. Joe first issue, and which was like unheard of for an indie title.
It was unheard of for just about anything in 2000, 2001.
Yeah, I can't remember the last – I knew this back then, like even for Image, like what was the last time an indie book sold that much? But, you know, previously to that. But Transformers, God, I think they sold like 250,000 units of it or something ridiculous like that. Because I had Hasbro reminding me of it every day. Like, why'd you only sell 150,000 copies? I'm not sure you know what you're doing.
One of the things I wanted to ask is I've heard and talked to creators who say that working on licensed books can be great because it's a lot of fun. The world's already set up. You get to play with their toys. But it also can be hell in that they go, yeah, the art in panel 4 and panel 7 needs to be corrected. Oh, I don't care if your deadline is Friday. It needs to be corrected, shipped back to us so that we can approve it, blah, blah, blah. Or you'll be going along with the continued story, and they'll go, we don't like where this is going. It needs to change.
Oh, man. You don't even know. It's like...
So, just to let people know what the creative process is like, what was your best licensed experience? You know, the people who are the easiest to work with. And then maybe one or two stories of licensees who you just wanted to... beat your head against a wall for an hour.
I'll just say, you cannot pick a harder way to enter the industry than to say, first try to do weird indie stuff that no one cares about, and then go into licensing. And every single book you're doing, you're working with this approval process with different companies, different personalities. So the fact that we were like had this track record we did and everything, I really commend everybody that worked for us. Especially when there's a bunch of, you know, 23, 25 year old people partying all the time, showing up at work and busting their ass every day. But, the best, you know, the Voltron people were like super cool to work with all up until the very end. Like we kept that relationship. I think we just kind of finally like let it fizzle out because the book just wasn't selling enough. And no one, neither, you know, we left things on great terms and just kind of was like, okay, there's only so far we can push this book. But everyone that worked for them understood their characters, and you know, they got it. And the good thing was it was like owned by one guy, and he had a small group of people who were under him who took care of the property. Hasbro was not the worst. That was my first one. It was the biggest one. It was the most important one. So it probably caused the most stressful and sleeping nights and waking up in the middle of the night, having a mini nightmare about an approval form not going through. That did happen more than once. But that was, I tell you what, when I first got that, they did not know who Snake Eyes was.
Unbelievable.
No one knew who Snake Eyes was, and I was used to licensing, you know, so I'm like, hey, do you have style guides? Because I was ready for all these rules. Because when you do t-shirts and merchandise, you literally have to take the pictures that they provide you and just paste them in. And you're allowed very minimal tweaking of those designs. So comics is different than that. But one, that's your first nightmare with a lot of licensors, is their licensing department, you know, account reps are used to just seeing an image come back that is the same thing they provided to the licensee and saying, okay, yep, you put Tasmanian Devil on this shirt. This is from this picture that we gave you. That's fine. And you added these words. So comics just totally like just screw up their world. And the worst experience of all was Family Guy. One of the best-selling books we ever did, but there's a reason we only did 3 issues.
I thought it was odd that there were only three because at doing the podcast and before that, I used to analyze the sales charts because I'm a really weird nerd like that. And I go, this book is selling really well. Where's the next one?
We
So you can
sold
explain why.
combined through like the we sold well over like 100,000 copies of that book and walked away from it. It was like, God, these numbers are just gonna make me cry afterwards because they're so high back then. But the you know what? It wasn't like huge in the comic shops. We sold like 7,000 copies, I think, an issue or something like that. But then through Blockbuster Video, they bought tens of thousands of copies to put on their end caps from Diamond. And then Hot Topic bought like 5,000 copies of one of the books. And then the graphic novel got collected and, you know, we sold a ton of that. We actually got stuck with a ton of those because Family Guy was so white hot. If people remember when that came out, or when, not even when it came out, because it took like 10 years to get popular, but when it did.
It was the second time when it hit the air the second time, you couldn't find anything of it. The DVDs were all gone in stores. I'd never seen anything like it because the show was canceled, was gone, and then Adult Swim and TBS kept rerunning it, and it would get higher ratings with each run through.
Because it wasn't even about DVRs and stuff. There was none of that real. I mean, they were there, but no one was using them. So, I mean, it was really just a weird. It was DVDs and reruns, like you're saying. But when it was so hot, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing Stewie's stupid face. Like, and it was so popular. So I knew like anything like that is that white hot. When it drops, it is gonna drop fast. So, that was, I'm kind of remembering this, how that went down. We put that trade paper back out in time for Christmas of 2006, and they pre-ordered like 10,000 copies. And then Diamond called me and said, oh my God, you have to go to press. You know, we were literally at the printer. I thought the book had already printed. He's like, you got to print 10,000 more. I'm like, I can't go back to press again. If I can bump up the press run, I could do that. Otherwise, it's going to cost me a ton, you know? And then there was time to bump the press run up to 20,000 copies. We sent the initial 10,000 out to the bookstores, and then nothing. Like they didn't reorder any of the extra 10,000 that Diamond like totally told me to print. And you know, they thought it was gonna like sell out immediately and have another big run, but like that was the Christmas season, the Family Guy, you know, just was done as far as a merchandising phenomenon. But that said, we would have probably taken a break at least for a good 6 months because, all right, we got the style guides, and then we had the artists. They had us hire their own animators. They're like assistant animators to draw the comic book. Like, we thought that was a good idea because, hey, these guys draw the book every day. Let's just get their own people. And then, but then they wanted us to hire their own writers. So, we're paying Fox. We got,
You're paying Fox to produce this and give it to you to print.
yeah, here's your advance. And then we're gonna give you royalties, and we'll hire you. You can give us style guides, which we'll turn around and give it back to your animators, give it back to your writers that work on the show. All the people that work with Seth MacFarlane, who's gonna look at, because he was micromanaging everything back then. He was looking at everything. At least that's what we're told. And then they would get an argue. They would disapprove and reject their own things. So someone, we're kind of, we were just every day like, what are we supposed to do here? And you have the normal things like, okay, Stewie's got nine, like seven hairs or nine hairs. Stewie's got this many hairs. Like, that's normal. Like, okay, the character in animation should have that much. But then it's like, okay, Stewie's pupil, every eye in Family Guy is like nine pupils wide. That's how big the pupil should be inside. So they would literally like move pupils around and like tiny, tiny little things that they would change to where we'd say, yeah, but we literally pasted this picture right here from your style guy you sent us. And they'd say, oh, well, that style guy's not right anymore. We changed it. So I'm sure that like the people that actually worked on the Family Guy were probably going through even worse than that. They were just getting paid enough to deal with it. But yeah, it was crazy. So yeah, I bet you if you talk to anyone at Devil's Due that worked on that project, they probably still think about it every now and then. Because it was also, there was one day where everybody in the office had to like just tell anyone who had any rudimentary Photoshop skills at all was sitting there like just flatting and like helping to like lay in the flat colors for certain books to be sent off to the colorist and just do help place pages or something. Like, I don't know. We had like everybody had to like just work to get this thing out because it was tied to these big Christmas deadlines and stuff. So yeah, good times. So yeah, now when I see all these license books, like that's why you have to drop a license title when it drop. You could keep your own creator-owned book going with a few thousand copies and build up your library, and you're enjoying making your book, you're getting it out there, you're expressing your creativity, you're building a backlist, starts to turn into residual money coming in. With the license title, if it gets down to like 8,000 copies, everyone's only doing that as work for hire, and then you have to pay off the royalties at the same time, and you don't get to own the project. So I don't know how like IDW and Boom and Dynamite and all these guys are doing some of these licensed books that they're doing. Because I see the numbers on them and I'm just like, this is brutal. I mean, I'm sure they probably got the art down to like some super nominal cost, and the printing these days is more favorable than it was back then for in a lot of cases. But man, I can't speak for them, but the only thing that makes sense to me is like maybe like IDW, gets licenses just to maintain the relationship with the licensor. And to, keep other people from having it on the shelf and to put it out so that when they want the really big license that they know is going to kick ass, they can come in there and get it.
You had another book that I remember being a big deal, and I was shocked that it went four issues. Barak the Barbarian.
Oh, yeah.
Looking through Devil's Due, you've got the creator-owned stuff, which we will get to. I promise we'll get to it. And I also, your relationship with First. We reviewed Badger number one a few months ago on the show, and So I know you've got first coming up, but Barak the Barbarian, first off, where did the idea come from? And second, the fact that you got four issues kind of, it's kind of interesting to me because I could see the first issue coming out and being huge because the Barak Spider-Man issue sold, what, like 700,000 copies all told? So tell me the story of Barak the Barbarian.
And then we did another one shot after that too. So see, here goes back to these original quirky origins of mine and the weird stuff I put out. So we were this was a really, really difficult time for the company. This was after 2008 crash. We had all kinds of issues with the bookstore returns and it was a mess. So all these Barak books were coming out, and I read in an interview that Barak actually read comic books that he collected Conan. Well, I'm from Chicago too, so we heard all about Barack Obama, all the way leading up to this. So some interview along the way, I heard he collected Conan the Barbarian and Spider-Man. And Conan always sticks out because my dad collected Conan. That was like the one comic book I had in the house growing up before I got into G.I. Joe and everything. So, I thought I wanted to do this just goofy poster to kind of capitalize on the comic book stuff. And kind of, I forget, it was like a conversation about just, hey, we should do something like this, but if we do it, it's just going to be like really weird and make people say, like, what the hell is this? Just to show it's kind of tongue in cheek. And it started off, Tim Seeley was still in the office then. I was like, hey, Tim, draw like a Barbarian Conan movie poster with Barak. Just have like, just as like a wink and a nod to this thing. He says he liked it and maybe we'll sell this poster. And I think he took it upon himself to draw like the Dick Cheney Toth Amon or whatever in the background and the big snake and all that stuff. But it ended up turning into like talking about doing a real story. And I thought, all right, we need to actually do a story that kind of does pokes fun at everyone, but also says something. Like it does have like a real, like some kind of substance to it, and is more than just like some gimmick cameo. So it's like the most absurd book ever, but it's actually probably the most really like thorough one. Like because the Spider-Man one was like a one-off thing, where all these little cameos were happening. Or they were just completely absurd. So it was like political satire. And then we actually did drafted. You know what? I've got the Chicago Tribune article for that. It's got the drafted poster. And we did a one shot there too, which was a much more serious story where it played it very straight. And what happened was because of all the press that the other books were getting, when I sent the press release out for that, it got picked up by the mainstream, and the Chicago Tribune picked up on it and put us on page three of the paper. So like you pick the paper up,
Wow.
front page, turn the page, boom, we're right there. And it had big pictures of the covers on it. And that's when I learned, like, if the Chicago Tribune picks up on anything, it's the same as doing a blast out to the AP, to the Associated Press, because it went everywhere. I mean, it was in other newspapers. It was in, like, London, in the Times. It was in Germany, in Die Welt. I did an interview on Breitbart about it. I think they thought the comic was a little different than it was, but I cannot find the video of that, but I did some video interview for that website. And then like Saturday Night Live made a joke about it. Because Chris, was it, who's that commentator, Chris Dodd?
Yeah, Chris Dodd.
The silver-haired fox. He made some weird comment about Obama's thigh or something like that. So they like made a joke. And then also it was weird because the main, like, we're so isolated in our comic book bubble, like present company included, like in our weird little geeky world we have, that when something like that breaks out of the mainstream and they're so disconnected from ever even reading comics or anything, the stuff they focus on is so bizarre. Like you got this, I'm thinking like, yeah, we've got this big like painted Conan picture of the president as this ridiculous, like, barbarian warrior and fighting other politicians and stuff. And the all they talked about was he was in a loincloth. The president was in a loincloth. And then, oh, but the formula there, too, was just even more absurd. I was like, you know what? We're going to put Larry Hama on this book. Hit him up about it. He was all about writing it. He had a coop because I thought it was extra funny because Larry is a contrast, you know, creator of all of the G.I. Joe stuff. But he's like a third or fourth generation Manhattan New Yorker. He's a veteran, but he's really liberal, but he loves guns. So,
and he's an actor.
Yeah, like, so people, I think people think Larry's this, like, cookie-cutter, gun-loving Republican guy. And it's like, actually, no, he's a Vietnam veteran, kind of, I wouldn't know if it'd be fair to say a disenfranchised vet, but, I mean, he knows what's really going on. Created this red-blooded American, you know, mythology. Loves guns, but he's a pretty strongly, like, minded Democrat at the same time. So it was like a, I just, you know what, Larry, just go do whatever you want.
That's right. Solitaire Rose Productions has sponsors. And our first sponsor is the one who's been with us since day one, and that's DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best web host in the whole known universe, bar none. Go to DreamHost.com, enter the code CRAZY, get $20 off your first year. How amazing is that? Our second sponsor is the Dollar Shave Club. I get amazing razors delivered from the Dollar Shave Club just for a few bucks, and I always shave with a fresh blade. Does this make me a genius? Of course it does. Now, if you use the website shave.by/C19DC, those of us here at Solitaire Rose Productions, we'll get to wet our beak a little. We get a little piece of that, and that's what ads are all about. Our other sponsor is Graze. Graze delivers great healthy snacks to you weekly, bi-weekly, once a month, however you'd like. You can choose the kind of snacks you want. They're all amazing. They're all healthy. They're all good. And your first and fifth boxes are free if you use the code CORYS3R5. We love to hear from you, our fans, our beloved fans. Without you, there's no us, because then we're just talking to ourselves, and Lord knows I spent long enough doing that. You can email us at our brand spanking new email address at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. You can call us and leave a message, and we will play your message on the air. And that number is 952-856-0519. We have us a webpage that is at Crazy Comics, KrayzComix.solitairerose.com. Over there, you'll see some of our new sponsors and our brand spanking new Amazon store. So go check that out. We are also on the Facebooks. We're all over the place. We want to hear from you. If you would like to advertise on Crazy Comics and Stories or any of the other Solitaire Rose podcasts, go ahead, email us at solitairerose.production@gmail.com. Subject, advertising. If you have a comic you would like us to review, it's the same Gmail account. Just instead of advertising, put review. Or if you'd like to be a guest on Solitaire Rose Radio or Solo Joe, go ahead and email us at that same address with the subject line guest. These here podcasts come to you free because of our sponsors, so please go visit them. Crazy Comics and Stories comes to you free every week. Every Monday, we've got a new episode, and usually we have it up by Sunday night. It's also available on the YouTubes. It's available on the Pocket Cast, on the Stitcher, on the iTunes. It's all over the place. So go ahead, subscribe, tell your friends, tell every human being you know about Crazy Comics and Stories. Solitaire Rose Radio is a little more infrequent. It comes out about every 2 weeks. And Solitaire Rose Novelcast comes out every other Thursday. So get ready. The Solitaire Rose Podcast Network is growing. Join us. Be on board. Become a fan. Become a listener. Thank you.